What did you want to be when you grew up? Did you have a path set out for you? Certain expectations to live up to? Did you ever have a sense that you were meant for something different, something greater? Or did you ever just want to say the heck with it all and drop out of the rat race altogether and start something new? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I've had my fair share of fantasies in which I am in charge, the ruler of some imaginary land. In truth, I don't want to be in charge of much more than my own bodily autonomy and choice. I don't even want to be in charge of figuring out what's for dinner. It's too much responsibility, too much pressure. But the subject of today's episode felt different. An immigrant from South Africa who amassed a fortune, fancied himself a leader, and fashioned himself a title to go with it. And no, I'm not talking about Elon Musk. Joshua Abraham was born in England in 1818 to John Norton and Sarah Norden. His parents took him and his older brother Philip and relocated to South Africa as part of the 1820 Settlers Program. The program encouraged between 4,000 and 5,000 British citizens from the Commonwealth to colonize South Africa in an effort to combat rampant unemployment in the UK, while also extending the reach of the Crown by adding to the number of white, English-speaking people in South Africa. Of the British colonists who moved to South Africa, 18 were Jewish, including the Nortons. Joshua's mother was pregnant at the time of their departure from England and gave birth on voyage to another son, Joshua's younger brother, Louis. John and Sarah arrived in South Africa with their three boys and continued to build their sizable family in their new home, having nine more children by 1832. Sarah deserves some kind of medal for bearing 12 children over 15 years. That's almost a kid a year, which means the woman was almost never not pregnant. One pregnancy was enough for me. I can't imagine not being able to see my own feet for over a decade. Anyway, once in South Africa, John Norton helped to build the area's first synagogue and set about making his fortune. Records say that Norton, quote, established a successful ship's chandlery. What the hell is a ship's chandlery, you may be asking? I sure did. Look, I'm from Brooklyn. What do I know from boats? I looked it up, and I guess it's like a furniture and accessories dealer for sea vessels? In spite of these accomplishments, as the years went on, the Nortons had financial difficulties. Maybe it was the 12 children he had to feed, or maybe he just wasn't good with money. A website operated by the Joshua Norton Trust, emperornortontrust.org, tells us, quote, by 1844, Joshua Norton's father, John, was up to his eyeballs in debt, and that this financial crisis had been brewing since 1840 or earlier, end quote. I don't know exactly why John Norton's finances were in crisis, but they were. And perhaps this is the reason that as the Norton brood all got older, they made a slow and steady exodus out of South Africa. The girls all married into Gentile families and left as soon as they could. In fact, all the Nortons rejected their Jewishness in one way or another. It's unsurprising, then, that Joshua, like everyone else except for two brothers, decided to peace out of South Africa, too. Joshua left in late 1845 and landed in Boston, Massachusetts on March 12, 1846. Joshua's mother, Sarah Norton, died in December of 1846, possibly while her son was in transit to the New World. Then Joshua's brothers both died between 1846 and 1848, and his father followed suit in 1848, leaving Joshua the sole heir of the family estate because, I guess, there was no question of leaving it to any of Joshua's sisters, even though Joshua's relationship with his father had been very strained. In letters to Joshua's brother Louis before their deaths, John Norton had nothing much nice to say about Joshua, though there is nothing anywhere really that explains why he had this unfavorable view of his son. He put it like this, quote, I am totally ruined. Everything taken out of my hand. No one looks at me. I am dead with shame and anxiety. We are all ruined. A complete curse is on us all for this last few years. Brokenhearted, sell all the firm property directly. Your brother Joshua has been the ruin of all the family. He has no compassion or remorse. I am more like a dead man than anything else," end quote. So that's very dramatic and intense. Because of this statement, it is generally agreed that Joshua was a disappointment to his father. Still, he became the scion of the family after John's death. Sure, give the estate to the son who ruined you rather than to any of the daughters. Though I suppose there wasn't much left to the estate anyway. How much money Joshua actually inherited is a matter of some argument, since John Norton was basically bankrupt by the time he died. Any creditors would likely have been paid out of the family estate, so it's possible Joshua did not inherit wealth so much as he inherited debt. One thing that seems certain is that when Joshua arrived in America in 1846 at the age of 28, he was alone in the world without much to his name. After his arrival in Massachusetts, there is little information to account for the roughly 3 years Joshua spent stateside. There is some speculation that he spent time in South America, possibly amassing a nest egg, but there is no real documentation of any of this, and Joshua's name is not included on the manifest for the ship he was alleged to have traveled to South America on. What we do know is that Joshua made his way to San Francisco one way or another in 1849 and got to work seeking his fortune there. Some sources say that Joshua arrived in San Francisco with $40,000 in his pocket, which may have been the residual remains of his inheritance. And if it was, what the hell kind of ruin was his father going on about? Or it might have been the money he made in his interim travels. Wherever he came by the money, $40,000 was certainly enough to get him started. San Francisco, during the gold rush, was a wonderland of opportunity, and Joshua quickly established Joshua Norton & Company, a real estate and importing concern. By some accounts, he'd turned that $40,000 into $125,000 by 1853. The trust finds some of the claims about Joshua's wealth dubious, given that the financial troubles passed down to Joshua by his father were not even completely resolved when Joshua was making a go of it in San Francisco. A quarter of a mil in 1853, stranger, is over $10 million in today money. That's a lot of cake. In the end, it is hard to know for sure what Joshua's financial situation was, but it does seem, even if the numbers themselves are in dispute, that Joshua did have some measure of success and was regarded as a prosperous and respected member of upper-class San Francisco society. Until December of 1852, when Joshua took some bad advice. That year, a flood in China created a rice shortage, and shipments of rice from China to the U.S. were banned. The cost of rice skyrocketed to 900% of its usual price. Joshua was offered a chance by a shipping merchant to corner the market by buying a scarce shipload of Peruvian rice at 12.5 cents per pound for $25,000 with an initial investment of $2,000 and a contract to pay the remainder in a month's time. It seemed like a no-brainer. Joshua stood to make a huge profit from the disaster that was starving Chinese people on the other side of the world by buying low and selling high. But what do you know? The day after Joshua signed on the dotted line, more shiploads of rice arrived from Peru, and they continued to arrive for weeks. Not only was there now plenty of rice, but Joshua claimed the rice he bought was of inferior quality to the sample he'd been shown. The price of rice swiftly dropped from 36 cents a pound, which would have netted Joshua three times his investment, to 3 cents a pound, which was less. Joshua tried to void the contract. After all, he had been misled. The seller, a man named Hermanos, in turn sued Joshua for non-payment in 1853. Hermanos lost, but he appealed and kept appealing up to the state Supreme Court. The final ruling in October of 1854 found in favor of Hermanos and ordered Norton to pay him $20,000. That would be over $720,000 today. Not exactly chump change. Joshua was so broke from the escalating lawsuits that he was even suspended from the Masons, which he had only recently joined, for not paying his dues. Things got worse for Joshua. He was accused of embezzlement, though the lawsuit was ultimately dropped because he took out a loan to pay the debt. The cumulative financial cost of all these missteps was devastating. Joshua tried to staunch the bleeding by running for San Francisco tax collector in May 1855, because nothing says financial trustworthiness like a slew of lawsuits for non-payment of debts. He then declared his run for Congress in 1858, but he was never even on the ballot, so either that detail is untrue or he didn't make it too far in his campaign. Joshua also tried his hand as a commission agent, brokering sales between customers, but nothing came of that venture either. Joshua Norton filed for bankruptcy in August 1856. He was officially, like his father before him, broke. What happened to Joshua Norton after his business dealings collapsed is unclear. Maybe repeating his father's mistakes and losing all he had built was just too much for him. There are some conflicting ideas about what Joshua did over the next 3 years to recover from his financial disasters. Some people believe he left San Francisco altogether for a time, but it seems more likely that he spent the period living quietly in a boarding house and possibly falling gradually deeper into a growing delusion. Or, depending on your point of view, shifting his worldview to think of his past successes and failures in a new way. Joshua did what any self-respecting person who'd lost it all would do. He declared himself Emperor of the United States. In September 1859, 3 years after going bankrupt, Joshua Norton finally came out of seclusion to formally eschew his prior identity as the South African son of a ship chandler, or the successful American businessman, or even the failed entrepreneur. He took himself on down to the offices of the San Francisco Bulletin, where he hand-delivered a letter declaring himself a new American monarch. Quote, "At the peremptory request and desire of a large majority of the citizens of the United States, I, Joshua Norton, formerly of Algoa Bay, Cape of Good Hope, and now for the last 9 years and 10 months past of San Francisco, California, declare and proclaim myself Emperor of these United States, and in virtue of the authority thereby in me vested, do hereby order and direct the representatives of the different states of the Union to assemble in Musical Hall of this city on the first day of February next, then and there to make such alterations in the existing laws of the Union as may ameliorate the evils under which the country is laboring, and thereby cause confidence to exist, both at home and abroad, in our stability and integrity." End quote. He signed the letter, Norton I, Emperor of the United States. Whether a testament to Norton's previous reputation and impact on San Francisco society, or a testament to the mean sense of humor of the paper's editor, rather than putting the letter in what my middle school teacher called the circular file, the Bulletin printed the letter in its unedited form in that evening's edition under the headline, "Have We an Emperor Among Us?" unintentionally launching Norton's whimsical 20-year reign over the United States. Many shook their heads when they heard what had become of Joshua, but not everyone thought he had gone round the bend from the stress and disappointment of his circumstances. Some thought he had actually gotten smarter, better. Actor-slash-philosopher and former hipster tour guide Timothy Speed Levitch said about Norton in 2012, quote, "Some say he'd gone mad, others say he'd gone wise," end quote. Whether urged by mental illness or something else, Joshua Norton went from being an ambitious and driven businessman at the heart of San Francisco's moneyed society to being a man of little means who called himself royalty. But he also became a vocal activist, an advocate for the city and nation that were now his permanent home. The citizens of San Francisco came to appreciate that this new Norton, the emperor, was more than just an eccentric. They began to see him as a man of the people, ahead of his time. Norton, it seems, became an indelible part of the local landscape as he challenged the status quo with all the pomp and bravado of, well, an emperor. Emperor Norton used his new imagined position of power to exert influence toward political reform. He wanted to, in his words, quote, save the nation from utter ruin. Same girl. In the course of his 20 years at his self-proclaimed command post, Emperor Norton made a number of formidable declarations and campaigns to improve the general well-being of his city and nation. In one example, the emperor called for Congress to be abolished, saying, quote, fraud and corruption prevent a fair and proper expression of the public voice, in consequence of which we do hereby abolish Congress, end quote. When Congress didn't willingly disband at his instruction, the nerve, Norton stated that the army should forcibly clear the halls of Congress, and he ordered military commander and political candidate General Winfield Scott to get in there and push the bastards out. The emperor's decree, which was published in the San Francisco Chronicle, read, quote, whereas a body of men calling themselves the National Congress are now in session in Washington City, in violation of our imperial edict of the 12th of October last, declaring the said Congress abolished. Whereas it is necessary for the repose of our empire that the said decree should be strictly complied with. Now, therefore, we do hereby order and direct Major General Scott, the Commander-in-Chief of our armies, immediately upon receipt of this, our decree, to proceed with a suitable force and clear the halls of Congress. End quote. Emperor Norton also called for the dissolution of the two-party system. He was a staunch critic of political, corporate, and personal corruption and fraud. He was a radical and vocal advocate for fair treatment and legal protections for immigrants and minorities, even demanding all the way back in the 1860s that African Americans be allowed to ride public streetcars and be admitted to public schools. Norton also declared the black-owned paper Pacific Appeal as his official paper of record, and they published most of his proclamations in the years that followed. One of the emperor's proclamations demanded that Chinese people be allowed to testify in court. On that matter, he declared, quote, the eyes of the emperor will be upon anyone who shall counsel any outrage or wrong on the Chinese, end quote. But his racial tolerance and advocacy didn't stop with black and Asian citizens. He also said that, quote, Indian agents and anyone involved in fraud against native tribes should be publicly punished before, quote, as many Indian chiefs, end quote, as could be assembled together, according to EmperorNortonTrust.com. The Trust goes on to list the emperor's many causes, quote, he supported women's right to vote. He was a defender of the people's right to fair taxes and basic services, including well-maintained streets, streetcars, ferries, and trains. He was an exponent of technological innovations that enhanced the public welfare. End quote. When there was a cholera outbreak in Tennessee, Norton ordered doctors from all over the country to help fight it. True, he threatened the doctors with imprisonment and fines if they did not comply, but imagine a leader insisting that public health come first. What a radical idea. At one point, Norton received a prank telegram that was attributed to Jefferson Davis about Norton's sympathies for President Lincoln, which read, quote, to His Excellency, Emperor Norton, it is with pain and regret that I learn you are in communication with that arch traitor Abe Lincoln, the so-called President of the United States. Is this true? If so, I cannot longer count you among my friends. The South has long looked to you as their guiding star to finally settle the present war. Please answer at once. With high consideration, I am Jefferson Davis, President, CSA. End quote. This just goes to show you that even though Norton might have had some radical ideas that didn't hold up, such as supporting prohibition or trying to dissolve the United States altogether in 1860 when he said absolute monarchy was his preferred political choice, he was mostly on the right side of history, which is more than one can say about his critics and political representatives of the time. In early 1866, after Napoleon III invaded Mexico, Norton added to his title of emperor, calling himself also Protector of Mexico. issuing the following somewhat patronizing statement, quote, "Whereas it is an undoubted truth that Mexico is entirely unfit to manage her own affairs, the country being in a constant state of internal distraction, anarchy, and civil war, and whereas His Imperial Majesty Napoleon III is throwing his protecting arm around unfortunate Italy, we consider it our duty to shield and protect bleeding Mexico. Now, therefore, we do hereby order and direct that a convention of the nation shall assemble in the halls of the Montezumas on the 5th day of July next, then and there to adopt such measures as will effectively protect her from the future internal dissensions and give security for her future stability and protection to the great foreign interests. And we also do hereby order and direct 10,000 troops of our army to assemble in the said city of Mexico on the said 5th day of July next, to enforce a proper and firm government adapted to the wants of the nation, to be composed of the proper men for such an object," end quote. A little white savory, but definitely bold and forward-thinking. Also, Unfortunate Italy is my new band name. The emperor and protector of Mexico was also a man of the future in his thinking about government and religion. He would rotate which religious services he attended, saying, according to Emperor Norton 2003 Encyclopedia of San Francisco by Peter Moylan, quote, "I think it is my duty to encourage religion and morality by showing myself at church, and to avoid jealousy, I attend them all in turn," end quote. Also, according to EmperorNortonTrust.com, quote, "He was a religious humanist and pluralist who favored church-state separation and warned against the dangers of Puritanism and sectarianism, refusing to give his imprimatur to any one church or synagogue, but rather attending them all. And he prohibited the enforcement of state Sunday laws which discriminated against Germans and Jews," end quote. This last part is interesting, as Norton was himself Jewish but did not identify as such. He believed he was a descendant of the Bourbon royal family of France who had been robbed from the royal cradle and given to a commoner family for reasons that are too complicated to get into. Clearly, the man had a lot of ideas. Maybe this delusion speaks to why he chose to take the identity of a monarch after his personal transformation. Anyway, he wouldn't be swayed from this bizarre belief. Don't, as we like to say in my family, confuse things with facts. The Trust tells us, quote, "In Norton's mind, the fact that his name was Joshua, Jewish, not French, convinced him that he was given to the Norton family to protect his identity as a Bourbon," end quote. So, Joshua had a few erroneous beliefs, and those beliefs probably did not go a long way to convincing folks that he was sane. In his research into Norton, historian Robert Ernest Cohen makes some references to mental illness that could be interpreted as suggesting schizophrenia. In one, Cohen says, quote, "Norton had already crossed the fine line dividing sanity from madness and was perfectly serious," end quote. Another says, quote, "Despite his delusion that he was royalty, His Majesty possessed a most inventive mind," end quote. But there is no such diagnosis in Norton's past, and while, again, he was seen as very eccentric, the idea that he had suffered from a delusional disorder is not borne out by fact or documentation. I mean, he was often seen wearing military uniforms, but what else can you expect from someone calling himself emperor? The physical description of Norton during this time, from The Rise of a San Francisco Cultural Icon by Dieter Martin in 2009, tells us, quote, "His garb was of navy blue, cut in military style and profusely adorned with brass buttons. The shoulders were surmounted with massive gilt epaulets, sometimes tarnished from exposure. In the early years of his reign, he had worn a military cap embellished with red trimmings. About 1865, one of his loyal subjects presented the emperor with a tall beaver hat, which was thoughtfully decorated with a cockade of feathers and a rosette. In 1867, one of his subjects had sent from Oregon a large and unusual specimen of grapevine intended for a walking stick. It was shod with a ferrule and gold-mounted, and thereafter constituted his scepter. He was never without it," end quote. truly royal. And yes, fans of his sent him gifts. Sure, arguments could be made that Emperor Norton was out of his mind, but while he had a flair for the dramatic, it seems just as likely, stranger, that during the reclusive 3-year period between his business failings and his major declaration, Joshua A. Norton underwent a personal transformation and developed a profound moral and ethical center from which he operated forevermore. He was a man who believed that a strong head of state was needed to hold the country together. He knew in his heart that the presidency, as it functioned, could not achieve this, so he placed himself in the role of leader. Whatever people may have thought of that choice or thought of the emperor, they came to accept him and his outlandish declarations in surprisingly progressive ways. By 1862, he was listed in the city directory as Norton Joshua Emperor DWL Metropolitan Hotel. Still, in 1867, Norton was arrested and admitted for an involuntary hold to address his, quote, mental disorder and to receive an official evaluation by the Commissioner of Lunacy. This is a real title. To be honest, Commissioner of Lunacy sounds a lot more far-fetched than Emperor and Protector. The hotelier at the Palace Hotel didn't know who he was dealing with and didn't like the look of the shabby military-clad Norton who was reading a newspaper in the hotel lobby. The hotelier ordered Norton to leave, and when he refused, attempted to have him charged with vagrancy, which was a crime back in the 1800s. Oh, wait, yeah, that's a crime again now, too. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling like it's 1862. Norton was released the very next day, according to the California Digital Newspaper Collection, with an apology and all of his belongings returned to him, including, quote, the imperial funds amounting to $4.75 lawful money, about $196 today, end quote. The arresting officer, Armand Barbier, was issued an imperial pardon by Norton. It is also said that all city police would salute him from then on. The newspapers all told the story of Norton's wrongful arrest, but the piece in the San Francisco Bulletin is my favorite. Quote, in what can only be described as the most dastardly of errors, Joshua A. Norton was arrested today. He is being held on the ludicrous charge of lunacy. Known and loved by all true San Franciscans as Emperor Norton, this kindly monarch of Montgomery Street is less a lunatic than those who have engineered these trumped-up charges. As they will learn, His Majesty's loyal subjects are fully apprised of this outrage, end quote. The upshot of all this was that it became clear that the people of San Francisco liked their emperor. They, quote, accepted his decrees with good humor and respect, even acknowledging their responsibility to contribute to his upkeep, end quote. Citizens would pay 50 cents a night to stay at Norton's Imperial Palace, which was actually a little room in a lodging house. Norton was allowed to pay at restaurants and stores with homemade 25-cent and 50-cent notes. He was given free theater tickets, and according to an Internet Archive piece, quote, upon his entrance, the audience always rose to their feet, end quote. A woman named Eva Hutchinson owned a boarding house where the emperor lived, and she and her husband had Norton's laundry charged to their bill. Hutchinson noted, incredulously, quote, Norton had trouble with the person who did his washing, not recognizing the imperial authority but demanding the same pay for washing the linen of the emperor as he received from his other customers, end quote. Ever the visionary, in 1872, after the Transcontinental Railroad had been completed, Norton called for the construction of a suspension bridge connecting Oakland to San Francisco. He also suggested that a bridge or tunnel could be built under the bay. This would end up being the route the BART takes. Ever the weirdo, when he was 63 years old, he sent a letter to a 16 or 17-year-old girl he was interested in that read in part, quote, my dear Miss Wakeman, in arranging for my empress, I shall be delighted if you will permit me to make use of your name. Should you be willing, please let me know, but keep your own secret. It is safer that way, I think. Your devoted, loving friend, the Emperor." End quote. Okay. Miss Wakeman thanked him for his interest and said that she was already engaged to another, and I guess that was the end of that. And he stuck with only his two stray dogs, Bummer and Lazarus. SFMuseum.org tells us that Bummer and Lazarus went everywhere with Emperor Norton. Quote, "No theatrical performance opened in San Francisco from 1855 to 1880 that three complimentary tickets in the first row of the balcony were not put aside for Bummer and Lazarus and Norton I, Emperor of the United States. It was a custom that held until that tragic day when his beloved mongrel Lazarus died and thousands of San Franciscans followed it to its grave where it was buried as a ward of the city." End quote. Not all of the emperor's decrees were politically and socially motivated. In 1872, Norton issued the Frisco Proclamation, which stated, quote, "Whoever, after due and proper warning, shall be heard to utter the abominable word Frisco, which has no linguistic or other warrant, shall be deemed guilty of a high misdemeanor and shall pay into the imperial treasury as penalty the sum of $25, around $650 today," end quote. So, we can tell he had taste. Then again, he also abolished the state Supreme Court. I have mixed feelings about this one. One decree, inspired after Norton was denied passage on a boat, said, quote, "We, Norton I, de Gracia, Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico, having been refused a passage by the Steam Navigation Company to proceed to Sacramento City, do hereby command the revenue cutter Shoebrick to blockade the Sacramento River and to bring them to terms," end quote. So he was not above retaliatory tactics. In a similar situation, after being denied entry to a high school graduation, the emperor proclaimed, quote, "Whereas some snobs in charge of the door refuted us admission to the graduating exercises of the girls' high school held at Union Hall on Thursday evening last, May 21st, now, therefore, we, Norton I, Emperor of the United States, and etc., do hereby decree their immediate dismissal and prohibit their future employment in public positions," end quote. Though one wonders what a dude in his 60s wanted with teenage girls. Then again, one tries not to wonder about this because not today, Bob. The emperor was a man of many interests and talents. He claimed to have invented a snow-melting machine that the city could use to supplement its water supply. He also supposedly invented a railroad switch that would make rail travel safer and more efficient. The emperor, suffice to say, was a complex and lively figure who carved out a sacrosanct place for himself in the landscape of San Francisco. Then, in 1880, Norton's landlady, Eva Hutchinson, said that she noticed he was getting up later than usual. Aside from that one detail, nothing foreshadowed that on the 8th of January, 1880, Norton would die suddenly. The Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico collapsed at the corner of California Street and Grant Avenue while on his way to the monthly debate of the Hastings Society at the Academy of Natural Sciences on Nob Hill. He died within 10 minutes of his collapse. He had suffered a massive stroke. When he was found, SF History Encyclopedia says, quote, "He had only a few coins on him, a gold piece worth $2.50, $3 in silver, and a French franc dated 1828 bearing the face of Charles X, France's last Bourbon king. He had a bundle of his 50-cent imperial treasury notes dated for repayment in 1890, He intended to exchange these notes for his original notes, due and payable this very month, which he could not have honored," end quote. In his room, another $2.50 in gold was found, along with Norton's collection of walking sticks, multiple hats and caps, and letters he wrote to Queen Victoria, whom he claimed to have had a romantic relationship with back in South Africa. There is, needless to say, no evidence of this relationship, or even that he'd ever actually met the Queen. Norton left no spouse or bereft lovers. Outside of his interest in young Miss Wakefield, he was never connected romantically to anyone that I could find. Nearly a century after Norton's death in 1965, Jose Saria declared himself Empress Jose I, widow of Emperor Norton. Saria was the first openly gay person to run for public office in 1961 and was buried next to Norton after his death. The few items found in Norton's rooms were the only material legacy of the Emperor of San Francisco. Still, Norton's impression looms much, much larger. His obituary in the San Francisco Chronicle described his death with florid reverence. Quote, "On the reeking pavement, in the darkness of a moonless night under the dripping rain, and surrounded by a hastily gathered crowd of wondering strangers, Norton First, by the grace of God, Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico, departed this life. Other sovereigns have died with no more of kindly care. Other sovereigns have died as they have lived, with all the pomp of earthly majesty. But death having touched them, Norton I rises up the exact peer of the haughtiest king or kaiser that ever wore a crown. Perhaps he will rise more than the peer of most of them. He had a better claim to kindly consideration than that his lot forbade to wade through slaughter to a throne and shut the gates of mercy on mankind." Through his harmless proclamations can always be traced an innate gentleness of heart, a desire to effect uses, and a courtesy, the possession of which would materially improve the powerful living princes whose names will naturally suggest themselves, end quote. Norton was buried at the Masonic Cemetery on January 10, 1880. The next day, while the church was collecting money to pay for a headstone, there was a solar eclipse. SF History Encyclopedia recalls, quote, "As they lay his body into the ground, the world grew dark with that phenomenon of infrequent occurrence, a total eclipse of the sun," end quote. It was actually a partial eclipse, but who wants to spoil the poetry? The Pacific Club paid $10,000, over $300,000 today, for the emperor's funeral. Many reports say that anywhere from 10,000 to 30,000 people attended the event, although EmperorNortonTrust.com actually puts it at about 30 people who attended the burial. Maybe there was a public event to commemorate his death that was attended by the masses. After all, the new governor of California was inaugurated the day before Norton's death, but it was Norton's death that made the front page news. In 1934, when San Francisco closed the cemeteries, probably because of sinkage and land development, Norton's body was moved to Woodlawn Memorial Park in Colma, California. He was reburied there with full civic and military honors, including the playing of taps and a 21-gun salute, according to SF History Encyclopedia. At this second burial, long after his death, approximately 200 people were in attendance, another testament to the lasting impact of this man on the community in which he lived. After his 20-year reign as emperor, Norton was indisputably an icon and was a widely loved mascot of all San Franciscans. FoundSF.org says of his life, quote, "He lived an oddly dignified life, participated in the daily life of the city, appeared at numerous theatrical and operatic openings, lived very frugally in his various rooms, and caused no one any harm," end quote. We should all be so lucky. Norton had been a living tourist attraction for San Francisco. Plays, articles, and books were written about him. Souvenir figurines of Norton were made to sell to tourists. The Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco and the mansion on Pacific Heights had rooms dedicated to Emperor Norton. The Pier 39 Resort in Fisherman's Wharf had a 10-foot wax statue installation of Emperor Norton. Mark Twain and Robert Louis Stevenson created characters inspired by Emperor Norton. His likeness appears in films and even video games. Mark Twain once said of Norton, quote, "Oh dear, it was always a painful thing for me to see the emperor begging, for although nobody else believed he was an emperor, he believed it, end quote. Norton is, to this day, considered a beloved son of San Francisco. The California Historical Society Quarterly said of him, quote, "The heritage of honor and integrity that he had handed down while in his affluence was never squandered nor dissipated, and so he bore the respect and goodwill of the best of his people to the end. The jokes played upon him had been harmless, and the merriment that he had sometimes excited had been without the bitter venom of ridicule," end quote. When the Eureka Lodgings building, where Norton had lived, along with most of the primary records related to his life, were destroyed in the 1906 earthquake and subsequent fires, the site became a four-story apartment building. In May 2023, in another tribute, the 600 block of Commercial Street was given the honorary name of Emperor Norton Place. There are many namesakes to the emperor, boats, restaurants, and who knows what else. The thing is that if you just look at the bare facts of Joshua A. Norton, a former businessman who used his inheritance to make a fortune that he later lost when he involved himself in a sketchy deal, a self-appointed monarch who took it upon himself to dismantle Congress and the Supreme Court, who believed the United States of America should cease to exist, and who supported the idea of dispensing with democracy in favor of a temporary monarchy, well, it all sounds uncomfortably familiar, doesn't it? He sounds like someone who shouldn't be humored. He sounds like someone who should be stopped before he inflicts permanent damage. But then, when you start to let in some of the attributes of his character, a passionate belief for social justice and in equality for the oppressed, a commitment to integrity and service, especially among elected officials, a spirit of religious tolerance, a spirit of whimsy, a desire to make the world in which he lived a better place with no material gain to himself, a commitment to live frugally and simply, and to be rich in social capital and culture. Well, that is a horse of a different color, isn't it? Here is a poem written about Emperor Norton, an unlikely American hero, by Dr. George Chismore. "No more through the crowded streets he goes, with his shambling gait and shabby clothes, and his furtive glance and whiskered nose, immersed in cares of state. The serpent twisted upon his staff is not less careless of idle chaff, the mocking speech or scornful laugh, he who bore it late. His nerveless grasp has released the helm, but ere the Lethean flood shall whelm the last faint trace of his fancied realm, let us contrast his fate with other rulers and other reigns of royal births or scheming brains, and see if his crazy life contains so much to depreciate. No traitorous friends or vigilant foes rippled the stream of his calm repose. No fear of exile before him rose, whose empire was his pate. No soldiers died to uphold his fame. He found no pleasure in woman's shame. For wasted wealth, no well-earned blame turned subjects' love to hate. No long and weary struggle with pain, one sudden throw in his clouded brain, closed forever his bloodless reign, with every man his friend. For death alone did he abdicate. What emperor, prince, or potentate can long avoid a similar fate, or win a better end?" Maybe Norton was ahead of his time, or maybe he was born at the wrong time. Maybe the man Joshua Norton became is the sovereign we need today. Maybe I should exchange my No Kings in America t-shirt for one that says, "No kings in America, but I will take an Emperor Norton." We can only hope history will remember the events of today with clarity and forget the despots who sowed chaos and harm, and that culture will choose again in the future to elevate and erect statues to the icons who were forged with goodwill, equality, optimism, and kindness. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we bring you our Pride episode just after Pride Month because I'm disorganized and also because, as far as I'm concerned, it's always Pride Month. The story of Juliet Hume and Pauline Parker, the so-called heavenly creatures. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by Eve Kerrigan and me, Daisy Egan, with research by Keely Hise. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.